On this episode of Video Culture, we'll talk about out-of-character movies, Continental Divide, and The Razor's Edge. You're not going to want to miss this one on this week's episode of Video Culture.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills, there will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Video Culture. I'm Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And we have two wonderful, very sort of touching, so I hope everybody's ready for their touchy feeling and ready to talk about life.
And we're going to get emotional today.
Yeah, a little bit.
And we're gonna slow it down a little bit.
Yeah, not like we need tissues or to cry about anything, but we're gonna kind of get in touch with, you know, what are we all about? Where are we all going? How our relationships are formed?
Gonna get into some deeper stuff today, people. This will be a Video Culture slow jam.
We're not gonna slow jam the show, okay? Just to be clear. All right. So, let's talk about the first movie that we have today, and it's a movie from 1981, and I'll go ahead and mention something very interesting about this movie that I will spoil it. This is a spoiler. This is the first movie ever released by Steven Spielberg's Amblin Entertainment.
That's true.
Yeah, so it's the movie is called The Continental Divide, or just Continental Divide, and it stars the late, great
John Belushi.
John Belushi. And John Belushi plays this, like, expose, Chicago Sun-Times, you know, reporter. And this is, you know, kind of a reporter that he's exposing, like, the mayor and, you know, for nepotism and, you know, just getting caught up in the, you know, the city politics. And he's really famous reporter.
Yeah, this is a movie that can really only exist in this time period because he's a rock star news reporter, the kind of thing that doesn't really exist nowadays. He was doing exposés and exposing corruption, and he's everyone in Chicago knows him, and it's hard to think of that nowadays. But he, in this film, he is a city renowned expose reporter.
Right, he plays a character. His name, I can't even say his last name. Is it Ernie Sobchak?
Sobchak. They say it like a gazillion times in the movie.
Yeah.
Sobchak.
Yeah, but it's kind of like the same name as, what's his name, from The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, it's almost like, almost like Walter Sobchak. I think it's spelled differently, but I think it's pronounced almost exactly the same way.
Okay, I think, does The Big Lebowski is like a B in his name? Maybe Sobchak? Or
no, I'm not sure. I don't know if they ever show it in the film.
Either which way, he is very famous. Like, everywhere he goes, people recognize him. People say hello, like, oh, you're that guy from the newspaper.
Or they're like, hey, Sobchak, good to see you, man. Loved your piece. And the idea that everyone reads the newspaper in this world, I mean, in the 80s, it was very common, but in 2018, it feels a little foreign and almost fantastical.
Yeah, because like right by his byline, where the story, there's his picture.
Yeah.
You know? And so, but the whole part of the story is not the story of being a reporter. No. The thing is because he's exposing the crime in the city, you know, they're kind of coming after him. The goons or whatever are you know, so he almost gets like robbed on the street and
yeah, his life is threatened because he's dealing with, he's battling all this corruption.
Yeah. So his, the head of the newspaper, his wife comes up with this great idea to go interview this lady who lives out in Wyoming and has been living there for, I don't know, how long did they say?
Just 3-4 years.
Yeah. Just living out there in the mountains, watching these bald eagles and studying them.
And this was kind of in the beginning of the time we were breaking, when America was getting really concerned with conservation. And this was one of the themes of the film was that there were only like 200 or bald eagles left in the world at this time. And she's studying the largest gathering of them out in Wyoming in this mountain range.
So the movie really takes like a twist and a turn because all of a sudden it's this like kind of fish out of water story.
Yes.
That goes from he's this expose reporter in the city in Chicago.
Kind of hard-boiled.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he's out trying to find this, like, lady talking about bald eagles. Like, this is not even a story that he would even, like, consider writing, really.
And it's basically, like, him traipsing through the woods trying to find her cabin.
Yeah, smoking cigarettes.
Smoking cigarettes, you know. You know, complaining about nature and right. talking about how much he misses Chicago.
Right.
And, he eventually meets this woman, and he's played by a really lovely actress whose name I sadly am blanking on at the moment.
Blair Brown.
Blair Brown, who's wonderful in this. She's just a really, really full of life in this film. So he meets this character played by Blair Brown, and they basically have a lot of
her name in the movie is Nell Porter.
Nell Porter. Yeah.
Nell. Yeah. So, and she plays this really sort of like rough and tough kind of character.
A headstrong kind of.
Yeah.
Like you know, real independent, you know, living life on their terms kind of person. And they obviously butt heads. I mean, he's this kind of headstrong person too, but in a different, in kind of an urban city way. She's sort of this headstrong, like, you know, nature person.
Right. But eventually he learns, like, well, not really. He learns, he kind of falls in love with her and starts, like, making passes at her.
Yeah.
And she's, like, thwarting his advances, and she's like, no. And then there's a really weird scene where this, like, other guy who lives out in the woods, like, she goes frolicking with.
Yeah, you find out that she has, like a guy that she hooks up with who lives in the wooded area, too. And, like, John Belushi's character gets a little jealous. And but throughout this time, basically, in this part of the film, it's a lot of, like, the romantic comedy staple.
Right.
Where they kind of butt heads, but they obviously kind of like each other and enjoy each other's company.
Right.
And so it does a lot of those kind of tropes. But what makes it really different, and this is what really is one of the more interesting things about the film, is really just seeing John Belushi in a different kind of role. I mean, he's not really playing a schlub.
Right. Well, this is, I mean, the reason that we chose these two films today is, I should just go ahead and mention, which I should have mentioned earlier, is that the two movies that we chose were roles of the comedic characters that we know who play mostly comedic characters. But this is their sort of like dramatic sort of breakout, right? Where they try to play a dramatic role. And this was one of the only, like pretty much the only dramatic role that John Belushi ever did.
I believe so. Yeah. And there are moments where it's funny, where he is funny in the fish out of water sort of way. But really, it's more about him discovering more about life than what he knows and slowly falling in love with this person as she slowly falls in love with him.
Right.
And it's got this beautiful, there's a lot of beautiful, like, snowy mountain scenery as they sort of had this kind of sweet, but yet a little bit comedic romance. And,
right.
And really, it's just discovering that there's more to his world than, you know, exposés and cigarettes.
Yeah.
And you know, talking about, you know, city life. And right.
Well, eventually the story winds up that they fall in love, but then he basically like has to, she's like, no, you gotta leave, like he's gotta leave because he's leaving, like the guide is gonna arrive and he's gonna take him back. So he goes back to the city. The story of him, like, he can't write because he's all like love struck. He writes this, like, really, you know, they're like, you got to write a story. He writes this really dumb story about
how in love he is, basically.
Right, yeah, this mushy story. The newspaper, like, like head of the newspaper is like, what is this crap? Calls him into this office and says, well, hey, let's go get a drink. Leaves it on his desk. And then for the evening paper, this is another thing too. A lot of people know about the morning paper getting, but there was like three editions a lot of times. It was like the morning, there was like the afternoon, and then there was like the evening. So for like the evening, they were like, oh, you always run Socek's story. So we just grabbed it off your desk.
So this embarrassing kind of teenage confessional romantic tale that he experienced gets published in the paper, and people in the city are kind of making fun of him. And and even the politician who he was trying to out for being corrupted makes fun of him. And that and that sort of relights the fire underneath him to bring this guy down.
Well, no, what really relighted him was when he found out that the informant that was giving him information, he found out that he accidentally...
Oh, yeah.
Like, something accidentally happened to his
car.
Fell
off a fire escape.
Fell off a fire escape accidentally. And, like, remember there was the scene where the kid was on the fire escape.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, I never get on those things or whatever. Like, he had a big thing about it.
You're right. Yeah, I'm completely glossed over that. But,
So he was like, well, I gotta crash this guy. You know, this is gone way too far. Now he's, like, killing, you know, this other guy. So,
yeah.
So he goes back into his old ways.
And he becomes the hard-nosed, like, pit bull reporter again. And again, this stuff with Belushi is really good. I mean, there's a really good film in this part of it. By the way, like a lot of the films we've been talking about, there's some weird tonal shifts. Because it goes from, like, this hard, like reporter story to being this romantic story back to being this reporter story for a while.
Right.
And they're good individually, but together it's a kind of a weird mashup of things.
It's like two movies in one movie.
Yes. And so basically, you know, obviously he exposes the corruption, drives the guy out of town, basically.
Right.
And so he's going, you know, John Belushi's character's won. He's the conquering hero. The freedom of the press won. The truth came out. And then Nell comes to Chicago to give a presentation at the museum about her Eagles. And then we slip back into the romantic part of the story as he realizes how much he missed her. And he goes to her at her, you know, her presentation and finds out how much she missed him.
Right. Exactly. And then they, you know, because at first he was even like the guy, the newspaper said, don't go. Because he didn't want him to turn into like this mushy guy again. And, you know, he even questioned like, should he go? Should he see her? All this kind of stuff. Or is that just like in the past? And then. You know, because really what's going to happen? I mean, she lives out in Wyoming. He lives in Chicago. How can they make a life together?
Yeah. And it's kind of explained in the scene where he goes to the museum. And it's really a kind of an adorable scene as he kind of talks himself into going inside the museum.
Yeah.
But once he's in the museum, he asks a question during the Q&A. He asks about, and this it seems like such kind of a vulgar joke at first, but it almost has the crux of the entire story in this one monologue. Where he asked during the Q&A, how do eagles have sex?
Right.
And it's explained, and I'm sure you can all look it up on the internet if you want to, but the eagles basically meet mid-flight, engage, and start to basically plummet towards the ground. And at the last moment, they break apart and fly their separate ways. And she explains this to him, and he's like, well, is that it? And she goes, well, not if they want to do it again. and that's kind of a cute moment, but so and after this moment they embrace and really realize that they still have feelings for each other, and they have this little like whirlwind romance. Mm-hmm. She has got to go back to Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And she's like, come with me, we can write a novel, we'll be happy. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know, I like writing my column, I like this is my home,
right?
I like my life, but I love you. And she's like, you know, I don't want to live in Chicago. You know, Chicago seems great, but my life is out in Wyoming with my birds.
Right.
So that really is the crux of the story.
Right.
And that's where the deeper meanings of the story come from, is how do you reconcile love, I mean, real intense love, with what else you want in life,
right?
With your career or your other passions. How do you make it all work?
Right.
And that's kind of the conflict that kind of wraps the movie up as they're going trying to figure it out.
Right.
And like they initially decide to just, you know, go their separate ways. She gets on a train.
Right.
And we have another film with a train.
Yep. Well, and this was a film that Amtrak actually signed off on. So you actually do see the Amtrak logo. Yeah.
And the train is portrayed in a very kind of idealized, kind of beautiful way.
Right.
But John Belushi, of course, rushes to the train, gets on the train with her, and basically pays for tickets along the way so he can stay on the train with her as long as possible.
Right, yeah, because he was going to leave, and then after that he gets back on. He goes, I'll get off at the next stop, and then they wind up hanging out together. And then after that, they come around, go, okay, we're at the stop, and he's like, he tells the porter, like, well, how much to the next stop? Okay, here's some more money. And basically just winds up paying his way all the way till she has to get off, right? And then they wound up getting married, actually.
Yeah, and he's waiting for the train to go back to Chicago, and they have 2 hours. And like right before the train comes there, he's like, well, let's just get married. And she, you know, of course, she's like, of course, I love you. I want to get married. We'll figure it out. And they get married. But as they're getting married, his train arrives.
Right.
And in that moment, they just decide, you know, and it's kind of beautiful in a way. He's like, I love you so much, I can wait for you. And and she's like, I love you so much, I can wait for you. And they decide to split their lives amongst both their wants, and
right.
picking a time during the year where they'll be apart,
right,
and then they'll be together. And right. it ends with him on the train waving goodbye to her, and then over the credits it shows a montage of them at her cabin,
right,
smiling and happy.
Well, okay, so let me now that we've gone through basically like a short synopsis of the whole movie essentially. Yeah. What did you think of John Belushi's, role as an actor? Like, you know, him playing this dramatic role of Ernie Sobchak?
Well, I think that, and I've got lots of thoughts about this movie, really. But I think at times it fit him really well. Like when he's the hard-nosed, like, bulldog reporter, he's great at it. But what he really fails at, and this, thankfully it's a small part of the movie, is really the fish-out-of-water stuff. Like, right. when he's supposed to be kind of, you know, uncomfortable with, like, in the woods and like hiking and all that.
Right.
But what surprised me the most about him was how well he nails the emotional scenes. Like, he's got kind right. of this kind of boyish, you know, sweetness about him when it comes to the romantic part of it. And it's really endearing. And you really want to see them be together. And it's
Yeah. I thought it was just funny him trying to play like I've never like him trying to look like he's frustrated at things. He yeah. just seems like a guy that would not get, like, sort of frustrated at stuff.
He would just blow it off, yeah.
He would just kind of laugh it off and yeah, go
he's,
on.
Because he's Pluto, let's face it. He's right. like, I don't, man, whatever.
I know, and it's like he's having to make these, like, grimacing faces or, like, get mad at this because this happened or whatever. You know, I also thought it was interesting that, like, she had to, like, come to his rescue, like, a couple of times.
Yeah, she's definitely the stronger one of the pair.
Yeah,
and to me that's an interesting because I mean, you know, it's rare in films to see that. You don't see a lot of it where the woman, at least at this point in film, and listen again, 1981, where she is portrayed really as his physical better,
right?
And really, in a lot of ways, his emotional better too, because she's more emotionally evolved than he is as well,
right?
And I mean, again, the character is wonderful. The actress did a wonderful job. She is. You can totally get why he would fall in love with her. She is magnetic in this movie.
Right.
And I mean it's a great character and a great actress to build a romantic story around because she's easy to fall in love with.
Right. I mean, all the other characters you know, in the movie besides like the head of the because there's not really many other characters in this movie.
No, it's almost a two-hander for most of it, you know.
Yeah. I mean there's the head of the newspaper guy and like his wife and then like he and now and then there's, you know, there's you know, a couple other very minor characters.
It's like they pop in for a moment and leave.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
It's really just those two actors for the entire film. And when you look at it that way, they pull it off very well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, because the core of the movie is their relationship. And their relationship is that it's very base sweet.
Right.
And the whole idea of how you can fall in love with someone despite your best intentions. You know, that's a universal idea, and it's something that we as human beings never quite get tired of. And I just like the deeper idea of how they love each other so much that they're willing to truly, truly compromise with each other.
Right.
Neither one wants to make the other one unhappy, so they make this this really beautiful compromise to basically find happiness in themselves, but also with each other. And
right.
Very much the ending of the film is very mature and very thoughtful. And you don't see that a lot. You don't see that kind of mature thinking in Hollywood very often. And yeah. I think that comes from the from the scripting by Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote the script.
Well, I mean, and I said that, you know, they're not going to be any tears or whatever, you know, on the show, but I can just imagine, you know, especially for, you know, other people, they might have a very, you know, sort of strong reaction to the end of that movie, you know, because it does end on such a sweet and romantic, you know, sort of gesture, you know, and then, there's sort of like getting, I mean, marriage is like a, you know, big deal. And then they're split apart where they're going to each sort of like live their lives separately, but, you know, be together in this, you know, sort of
emotionally. More, yeah.
So, I mean, because, you know, he can't, you know, he can't be in that world. She can't be in his world. And, you know, what do you do in that moment?
When they can find time for each other, they'll find time for each other, and they love each other where that's enough.
Right. But yeah, you're exactly correct in like explaining, you know, the thing is, of their relationship together is, you know, the analogy of the, you know, of the eagles, you know, in their mating, you know,
yeah.
Of together. And then at the very last second, splitting up at the end.
Yeah, it's also an allegory for the complicated nature of relationships. So often this is where we're going to get deep today.
Yeah.
Often this is where relationships fail.
Right.
People aren't willing to compromise. They'd rather crash then break apart and reevaluate and see if they want to do it again,
right.
Basically, to use a line from the film.
Well, it's true. I mean, you know, I know that you have, you know, sort of counselor background. I mean, and if you don't have that foundation where you want to go to the same places, then, you know, you're going to wind up in very different places.
Yeah. But if you're mature enough, you can express and talk with someone about your feelings, then you can make it work. But you have to be willing to be open and willing to let someone have their space to, again, not to be too cheesy, but to fly.
Right.
And that's, you have to have your own, you have to be willing to give that person a chance to break free. And
well, yeah. Well, I mean, and I like in the movie how, you know, plot wise though, how he, you know, he sort of had to adapt to the world that he was in. Right. And where he had to like make the door and he had to like, you know, sleep and get used to sort of his surroundings and just like living in this cabin, you know. And at the end, like at first, she's like chopping wood and he's like, what are you doing? And then near the end, he's chopping wood.
Like it's no big deal.
Yeah, yeah. Like he's okay. This is just something that you have to do. Like, okay, you know. But then after that, like when she comes to the city, she's just like, okay, I'm at the city, you know, it's just, she falls into the city life.
And they're able to adapt to it for a while.
Right.
But it's not who they are. And
right.
And again, it goes back to the subtle maturity of it all. They realize that about each other. Mm-hmm. That, you know, they may want for the other to, you know, adapt to their life and, you know, be a part of their world as they are. But, I mean, what's beautiful about the film is, again, the idea that you can love someone but not have to have them, you know, locked in a vice grip. You can let them be free and be on their own and still emotionally love them and be there for them, even if they're not, they're right there by your side at every moment. And, you know, and there's some flaws in the film. It looks, the tone is all, you know, weird. Is there some tonal changes? There's some weird character asides. And like at one point, John Belushi's attacked by a mountain lion.
Yeah. That's what I was saying about the rescue part. It's like he does like have these very sort of helpless moments where she has to come and like rescue him.
Yeah, he's really kind of almost the damsel.
Yeah.
But my point is, despite those kind of weird like structural things, yeah, and like from like the craft of making a film, the heart of it and the thought behind it and the emotion behind it really elevates the film and makes it something that's very worthwhile.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a perfect film by any means.
Right. And this is a movie that you hadn't seen before.
Oh yeah. I would like to point out, this is a rare occasion where I had not seen either of these films before doing this project, and I had not even heard of this film until you brought it up to me.
Oh wow!
So I'm really grateful you to have introduced me to a film I didn't even know existed.
Usually it's the other way around.
Yeah, because it's a fun thing for me to be like, I never heard of this. When you mentioned to me, I just give you a blank stare. But it's a very interesting.
I was like, you should know this movie. It was the first movie by Amblin Entertainment. Like, what? You know, so.
And my response is often this: I can't know everything. I know a lot, as I am a film journalist.
It goes along with these other, you know, sort of touching films, like from the same, you know, sort of time period or whatever. You know, because there was a lot of that, you know, sort of, you know.
It's kind of that come down from the 70s.
Yeah.
The 70s were where we're kind of a dark time in film, where you get into a lot more indie film, and the directors were fascinated by the reality of life and the bitterness of life. And the 80s were them kind of coming back around and saying, hey, life can be sweet and kind of pretty and wonderful if you let it.
Right.
And like I said, movie's flawed. There's no mistaking that. Yeah. There's some things that.
Yeah, the pacing is kind of weird.
Yeah.
And like you said, the intro, you have the city, and then out there, and then back in the city, and then the weird ending part. So,
yeah,
it's kind of like mashed together to try to tell the story.
But the heart of it makes it work, and the heart of it, and these concepts, that, like I said, these deeper things that it makes you think about,
right,
by itself make the movie worthwhile and worth recommending to people. If you're a fan of romantic films, if you're a fan, especially if you're a fan of John Belushi, I mean, so you'll never see John Belushi portrayed in this way again. I mean, it's a very different kind of role for him. It's unique and interesting.
Right.
And you know, and if you're a fan of portrayals of strong women in film,
right,
they're a wonderful lead character,
right. Well, we have a lot to talk about today, so we're gonna move on to our other movie.
And it's a doozy.
I mean, there's so much to talk about. I mean, I don't know if we're even going to have like an hour to talk about all this.
Yeah, we may have to go a little long on this one because there's a lot to talk about.
Okay, so the second movie, The Razor's Edge.
The Razor's Edge, a passion project for one Mr. Bill Murray.
So the story goes, and this is another part of the reveal of the, you know, interesting facts about the movie that I will reveal now, because this is what to me kind of makes, you know, if you haven't seen this film, this, you know, this one fact should go, okay, I need to go see it right now, is that Bill Murray is, you know, most famously in the beloved Ghostbusters films, Ghostbusters 1, Ghostbusters 2. Before he was in Ghostbusters 1, his role of Venkman was written for John Belushi. Now, John Belushi passed in 1982. Ghostbusters was made in 84. So the project was already greenlighted. But they still, you know, Columbia, you know, they still needed somebody. They were like, yeah, Dan Aykroyd, sure. Yeah, we'll do your movie. Fine, you know, get Bill Murray to play Venkman. We'll do it. So they asked Bill Murray. He said, no, I'm not going to do it. It was Dan Aykroyd's idea of like, why don't you, because Bill Murray wanted to make this movie, The Razor's Edge.
Razor's Edge.
Which is a novel that was written in the 40s. And it's this real sort of weird movie about life. And so Dan Aykroyd says, why don't you tell Columbia that if they'll make the movie, then you'll do Ghostbusters. He said, okay. He went to Columbia and said, hey, do my movie and I'll do Ghostbusters. They said, sure, we'll do it. So we have The Razor's Edge.
And The Razor's Edge, again, it's a movie about life. It's basically about, I'm going to give you the elevator pitch right now.
Yep.
It's basically about a World War II ambulance driver who, after surviving the war, goes on a spiritual journey to try to discover the meaning of life and his own existence.
Sounds like a drama.
It is very much a drama.
It's like, okay. It's a movie about life.
It is a movie about searching for understanding and meaning.
Yeah.
Where occasionally Bill Murray does Bill Murray things, and it's right, a little bit out of place.
So Bill Murray plays this, because he's this, like, one ambulance driver with, like, who comes back with, like, survivor's guilt. And he just, instead of doing the thing that he's, you know, was supposed to do, which is like marry the pretty girl and go work for his, you know, buddy and be a stockbroker, he's like, you know, I want to figure out life.
Yeah. So basically the movie opens with him as a young man and his buddy volunteering to go drive ambulances for World War One, or not for, for the Allied forces in World War One, because America had not yet entered the war.
Yeah, there was the Great War at this time.
And so basically they go, in the beginning it opens with a very kind of, you know, typical like picturesque Norman Rockwell-esque picnic where they're celebrating these young men who are going to go do this brave thing. And then it smash cuts to basically the front lines of World War One, and where they're basically driving this ambulance in the worst possible scenario you could possibly imagine. Where they're in a regiment of basically ambulance drivers that's been decimated down to just two other people besides themselves. And that regiment is led by Bill's older brother, the great Brian Dole Murray, who is really wonderful in this movie as kind of the hard-nosed, veteran, ambulance driver who kind of guides them through how to survive this hellish thing that they've gotten involved in.
Right.
So basically what happens, and again, we're going to go to spoilers. We hope you'll watch this movie regardless, but we have to talk about the progression of it to really explain what the movie is about. They basically get surrounded at one point early in the film, and Brian Dole Murray's character gets him killed protecting the rest of them. And this leads to the trauma and the stress that Bill Murray's character feels. And there's a really touching scene that I want to talk about. And I know we normally save trivia for the end, but there's a touching scene where after Brian Dole Murray's character's passed away, Bill is kind of over him, and he says what's basically an impromptu eulogy.
Right.
And it's a really kind of maudlin, kind of cheeky but sad thing where he basically sounds like he's insulting this man, but he's really secretly talking about how much he's going to miss him.
Right.
And it's very poignant and it's very real. And I'd like you to tell the listeners why it feels so real.
Well, it's because that excuse me. It's because that eulogy was essentially the eulogy for John Belushi. And earlier in earlier in the film, you know, the Harvard guys that come up with this really expensive, like brand new, like white, like, you know, gold plated, like, you know, stuff. They get blown up.
Yeah, there are other ambulance drivers who volunteered from Harvard to come in with a very expensive ambulance, yeah.
And they get blown up. And so Brian Dole Murray's character, you know, the veteran, he starts in with this, well, they were a bunch of liars. They were liars. You know, we didn't like them. And it's basically just to try to compartmentalize the feeling of loss, right? Yeah. To kind of say, well, they deserve to die. They were not good people, you know, whatever. And the way that the eulogy starts, it's kind of the same way.
Yeah.
It's like, you were, you know, a jerk.
Yeah, did you ever see him eat?
Did you see him eat? He had food all over his mouth. Like, dogs would, you know, be at his feet, you know.
Dogs would gather around him. You could feed scores of children for what fell into this man's beard. But he's saying this, and it's really a beautiful bit of acting from Bill Murray, because he's near tears.
That's because I don't think it was acting.
Yeah, I think that he was thinking about Belushi. He was thinking about his own brother who was laying there acting as if he had passed.
Right.
And it's raw, and it's beautiful in a way.
Right.
And also, it was also the first, 15 minutes of the movie? It's really early in the film.
Yeah.
So we basically cut right from that scene to, honestly, probably about 6 months later, Bill Murray and his buddy are back in the States.
Right.
They've been home for a month or two.
Right.
They're just kind of, you know, living life again back in America.
Right.
You know, his fiance is waiting for them to get married, and she goes to Bill. His character's name is Elliot.
Right.
It says, well, you know, you've been kind of, you know, bumming around for a month or two. It's time to get married and go to work. And he says, I don't think I want to.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe later, but not right now.
Yeah. And it's like, what? Teresa Russell's? No, that was Sophie. The one that played Catherine Hicks, is that her name?
I believe it was Catherine Hicks, yes.
Yeah. I mean, she was in like Seventh Heaven, and she was also in Star Trek IV or whatever.
She was in Star Trek IV, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, she plays like a wonderful character. I mean, it was so. Yeah. I mean, I really like a lot of stuff that she's usually in. She didn't play a very likable character in this movie.
Well, she has a progression. At first, you kind of feel like you feel bad for her because she obviously loves Bill Murray's character, but he's gone through this and obviously he's changed.
Right.
And he decides to go basically to Europe to find himself. Right. And then he just never comes home.
No, he winds up being like, and you have to understand too, that this is like a, you know, period film. So yeah. It was like, you know, in the late 30s or whatever, or mid 30s, and or no, it was like more like the 20s, right?
It was before the stock market crash. It would have been the early 20s.
So he goes over to France, and you know, he's pretty rich, comes from a pretty wealthy, you know, family or whatever, but he doesn't have to like work. But he does. He like works in like a cheese factory or something.
He basically works odd jobs for doing like market work, and like at one point he's digging coal in Britain.
I mean, this is a guy that could be living in Chicago as a stockbroker, getting like manicures every day. Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, but here he is. He's living in France, just in this small tiny apartment,
trying to find himself, and he's reading books on philosophy and religion. And in his coal mining job, he meets a British man who's also kind of fascinated by philosophy and religious writing. And they're talking, and the man says to him, "Well, have you been to India?" And Elliot, Bill Murray's character, goes, "No, what's in India?" Mm-hmm. And the guy goes, "Well, besides about a million people," he talks about the idea of truth being there, that there's true spirituality there.
Right.
The true search for meaning.
Well, he tells them that you're not gonna find it in any of those books.
That's true, because you can't find real meaning in a book. Mm-hmm. You can't find real meaning in a film. But we'll get more into that, the ideas of it soon. So basically, Bill Murray goes to India, and at this point, I wish to say this movie looks friggin' expensive.
It cost $16 million.
Only $16 million?
Yeah.
It looks so much more expensive than that. I mean, it's shot with beautiful CinemaScope cameras.
Right.
Like, I mean...
But there wasn't a big cast. They used natural sets. They didn't have to build a set for any of the stuff. There was no, like, real special effects. I mean, this is, you know...
But this is a very... I mean, it's an epic film. I mean, it's sweeping in its scope. Right. It really is.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he goes to India. He goes to Nepal at one point.
Yeah.
You see him scaling mountains. He meets with holy men and you know, swamis, and basically starts learning about spirituality from that aspect. And then basically it kind of glosses over a little bit that you see him basically putting on robes, and then it cuts away to back to his friends in America. See some of their tribulations that they're going through. They're having a hard time as they're dealing with, you know, financial problems and things like that.
Yeah. Well, he goes back after his trip to India. He's kind of like a changed, you know, sort of guy.
Yeah. They gloss over kind of this moment where he goes to this temple, and then they cut to like what, probably a few years later, and he's kind of attained a level of calm.
Right.
A level of peace, a level of knowing.
Right.
In psychology, we call it self-actualization. He's actualized. He understands that there's more to the world. He truly understands there's more to the world than himself.
Right.
And he's calm.
Right.
He's serene.
Right.
And this goes into the title of the film, The Razor's Edge. As he's getting ready to leave the temple, his holy friend in the temple goes, "When you leave here, know that the path of a holy man, to walk the path of the holy man is difficult as if you're walking the razor's edge."
Well, that actually comes from the original book, because there's the book, The Razor's Edge.
Yes.
But the book, The Razor's Edge, talks about the Katha Upanishad. I think that's how you pronounce it. I don't know how you pronounce it.
I'm not sure.
But it's basically one of the books, one of the Hindi books or whatever. So, but in the book, and I'll read what it says, the path to salvation is narrow and is as difficult to walk as a razor's edge. So, you know, it kind of to me, and in that philosophy, you know, where you have this, like, you know, path to salvation or whatever, and is to walk as a narrow's edge, kind of, you know, to me signifies, you know, this idea of, like, when there's an event that happens, like, you can make tons of choices on how you react to it, right? But the right way is only going to be, like, this very sort of narrow path.
And a very difficult path.
And a very difficult. And not the one that veers left and right, because you don't want to move forward through that path because it is very difficult, you know?
If it was easy, everyone would search for that enlightenment.
Right.
And so basically, he basically goes back to France. And I don't think we should go through every plot point because there's a lot that happens in this film. But basically, he ends up getting reunited with his childhood friends. And he's basically, he helps them with things he's learned. But he also faces trials and tribulations.
Right. Well, yeah, because the girl that he was with, I'll just kind of break it down real quick. The girl that he was with winds up marrying his friend. So she's getting, like, what she wants out of life, which is, like, she wanted kids and she wanted, you know, a family and whatever. But he, like, the stock market crashed in 1929. So they moved to France.
Because they're poor suddenly.
They're poor. And so they don't have anywhere to sort of, like, live. And everybody's, like, sort of after their stuff. So at least they can have somewhat of a life in France. But it's still not their home. And then the other girl that was his other childhood friend, her husband
dies
in, like, a car wreck. And she's kind of this, like, alcoholic she's kind of like, well, forget this crap, you know, and she's just kind of like this lost sort of soul. And so he kind of, like, takes her aside to try to, you know, enlighten her path, basically.
He basically does it for all of them. He tries to do it for all of them.
Right.
Try to basically bring the sense of knowing and peace and calm that he's found to their lives. And in some ways he's successful, in some ways he's not. But I don't think we should go into too much of how the movie wraps up, because I want to encourage people to see this movie.
Right. Yeah. Well, like the one scene where he comes back, his sort of first scene of this is his childhood buddy that he went to, there was an ambulance driver with. He's, you know, his father, they've lost all their money, right, because they lost in the stock market. His dad has died. So they're living in France away from home, and he's sort of like this sort of depressed. And they didn't have a word for it back then. They didn't really use the word depression. But he's just like, he's just like sitting in bed, and he's like, I get headaches a lot.
Yeah, I mean, just like Brian Wilson or somebody.
Yeah, right. And he's like, yeah, I get headaches a lot, and I just get worn down, and I just have to sit here and until the pain goes away. And he's like, has him, like, refocus his energy on this coin or something.
And he basically does, he basically uses some mild hypnosis to basically help his friend get over his depression and his headaches.
Right.
And it's filmed like he's doing something very mystical, but really it's just very, very mild hypnosis.
Right.
But basically, it's
just like a hypnotic suggestion or whatever.
Yeah, and that stuff can work if you're open to it.
Right.
But really, it's just to illustrate that he's been, again, trying to bring these things he's learned about himself and the idea of, you know, being selfless and giving to his friends.
Right.
And in some ways he's successful, in some ways he fails.
Right.
But again, the movie is about how he continues to walk that narrow path of enlightenment, searching for salvation. And there's a line in the movie that was really poignant to me, and I'm going to go in. It's near the end of the film, and I won't give you the context. I feel it's a big spoiler, but he goes, I thought there would be a reward, a big payoff for living a good life.
Right.
But there's not. In the end, the reward for living a good life is living a good life.
Yeah.
And I
laugh only nervously.
Well, that's a heavy thought.
It is.
Because, like I said, he again experiences trials and tribulations, but he stays true to his idea of peace and serenity and honestly loving.
Right.
He's a very loving character, and he never quite loses that sense of hope and wonder, and to me that's fairly inspiring.
Well, let's talk about the movie overall. I mean, you really have to be I mean, Bill Murray's playing this very sort of dramatic role. It's a very sort of very much of a departure from him, even from his Saturday Night Live stuff. I mean, and obviously it's a departure from, it may not be a departure for some people because he's been in like, you know, Lost in Translation. Well,
he basically got back to that later in life. Like it took him what, 30 years to get back to doing those kind of, the kind of work.
Right.
You can tell he wasn't quite comfortable doing it in the Razor's Edge because when he's called on to be a little humorous, to add levity to the movie, it's almost jarring because suddenly he becomes Bill Murray again. Yeah. Like the humor he has in the movie is so very much like 1984 Bill Murray that it's almost like suddenly you're watching Venkman, you know?
Yeah, like when he gets out of the pool for the first time, she's like, no, talk to me. And he's like getting out of the pool like a seal or something like that.
And
you're
just,
like,
just goofing around or when
he's like doing meatballs, you know what I mean?
He's doing like wordplay jokes and like a little bit of physical comedy. Yeah. And it's funny because it's Bill Murray's funny. But it's a little jarring with the other stuff, and it's kind of sad because when he commits to what's going on, he's quite good at the kind of, you know, serene stuff.
But when he's still trying to have this like profound look on his face, this sort of like strong, silent, like, you know, he just looks a little lost. Like, and looks a little goofy, like he doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, like he's a little bit spacey still.
Yeah, like he's sort of unsure of himself. I mean, I think that's the crux of it, is that he sort of lacks sort of confidence to really commit.
Like he does, I feel like he does a good job, but I will say this, in all fairness, he is the weakest part of the film.
I agree.
I mean, if you imagine this film with someone like, I don't know, I'll just throw out a typical actor. Like, imagine it with young Pacino. Like how Pacino could have nailed something like this, or like, you know, young Robert Duvall. Imagine Robert Duvall in a role like this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it would have been even more.
I mean,
poignant.
Even like Brad Pitt or somebody like that. Yeah,
if you can imagine it in a more modern context, for sure. Because Brad Pitt has that serenity,
right,
that Bill Murray just can't quite, or at least at that point in his career, could not quite capture.
Right.
But still.
Because the really reason why is because there's not a lot of character transformation that you see, you know? I think other actors might have, you know, done a little bit, you know, a different, I don't know. It would be hard, you know, it'd be hard to say, to imagine somebody else doing it. But it's like you don't really see a lot of character change. All you see is a lot of stuff sort of happening. And the whole movie, I mean, I watched this movie, and I got, like, you have to realize this movie is 2 hours long. I got about an hour into this movie, and I'm like, I still don't know what this movie is about. What is happening?
What's funny?
What is it building to? What is it going to? Because normal movies, as you know, like, have this introduction, then you have conflict and rising action,
a three-act
falling
structure,
action.
Yeah.
This is does not follow that whatsoever.
It doesn't.
And if you're going to want to have that, this is not going to happen. This movie is a lot like what you mentioned before in the 70s, where it's more like real life,
where things just kind of amble along.
Yeah,
and you don't see a lot of the character development because, again, they kind of cut away from like. Like, I would have loved to have seen, like, his growth when he was in, like, the monasteries or when he was in the holy places. That would have been interesting, but they brought him there, and then they cut away, and they cut back, and suddenly he's this more spiritual person. You don't get to see any of the evolution. He's just there.
Right.
And I think the movie, like I said, I think the movie is very much worth watching. It is a fascinating movie.
It is very, very fascinating, and it's there's a lot of... you know, there's a lot of sort of sadness, and there's a lot of like death, and you know, to me, I don't think the movie. I don't want to talk about the ending too much for those that haven't seen it, because this is not one of those popular movies that we can like just guess it. You know, you've seen this movie, is that it didn't really have a very finite resolute.
It's not Hollywood at all.
No, and it doesn't make you feel good when you leave it all. You know.
Well, again, it goes back to find true peace, difficult,
right?
And to find, to accept the world and to be at one with the world, that's challenging and hard. And the world's going to make it hard for you the entire time. Right. And I think that was kind of one of the points of the film was, you know, it's admirable to be at peace and to be loving,
right,
and open to people, but the world's going to make that really, really hard for you.
Well, I mean, I remember reading some reviews and stuff like that, and it's interesting to read what other sort of people get out of it. You know what I'm saying? And it's one of those movies that is like that. Everybody that probably watches this movie is going to take away something about themselves or about life that, you know, that they think is like the most important thing. And it's not the same thing for every person. You know, one of the reviews that I read talked about how no matter what Elliot did, sadness was still going to occur in his life. No matter how enlightened he was, it wasn't going to, you know, life and sadness are still going to happen no matter what he tries to do.
I think that's a life lesson in a lot of
ways. Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, but that's what I'm saying. Other people see it as, you know, this sort of, what is the path to righteousness, or like some of the things that you were saying. I mean, and that's what I think that is so profound about this movie, because it does touch on a lot of those things and you do sort of get it. And now I see why, you know, to me, the thing that I got out of it from like just a movie watching experience about it and about knowing about Bill Murray, knowing about how this movie, you know, got greenlighted, was why Bill Murray fell in love with this book and why he wanted to do it and why it was such a passion project for him.
I mean, it's got some really interesting deep ideals. And if you mull over them, it's a lot to chew on. Like I said to you earlier today, when we have our little pre-production meetings, you know, because we're professionals, we have these right. pre-production meetings. I call the movie a noble failure. But the more I sit and think about it, the more I sit and talk on it, I think it's more successful than I gave it credit for in the beginning. It's still got flaws. You know, it's still because any movie that's that unique of a vision yeah. is going to have flaws. And the flaws are sometimes really hard to ignore.
Right.
But
well, we're looking back on this movie now. At the time, it was a complete disaster.
Yeah, I can't imagine I love Meatballs. Let's go see the new Bill Murray movie.
I love Ghostbusters because Ghostbusters actually came out before. Yeah. I mean, that came out like earlier in the spring. Yeah. This movie comes out in September, and you're like, oh yeah, we saw that Bill Murray flick. Yeah. He's in this movie. Let's go see that. And this is just like not even close.
Yeah, it is. It is way. It's even a hard movie to explain.
Yeah.
Like even if the feeling the movie gives you as you're watching it, it's like it's really a melancholy kind of movie.
It is.
And it's a movie that you have to sit with for a while because it's long.
Yeah.
And stuff, and a lot of stuff happens, so it feels longer than it is. You're talking about watching it and being an hour into it, not knowing where it was going. I actually was watching it, and I paused it thinking it was nearly over. I was going to go get a drink. And I was shocked when I saw only an hour had passed.
See, I was the like, same thing. Yeah, an hour go by.
And it's not that it felt super long, just right. so much had happened.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's like four movies in this 2-hour movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not that there's a lot of tonal whiplash, just so much happened that it's such a sprawling story.
Well, I think it just shows part of the Elliot character and the different lives that each of us can make. I mean, if you made a movie of like my life, you know, like it's all over the place. Yeah. Like part of my life, you know, you can do a movie of my college life. You can do a movie of my, you know, my first job. You can do a movie, you know, of, you know, my married life with my kids. I mean, there's tons of movies. And I think that there, you know, a lot of that, you know, in this time when you're young, a lot of that stuff sort of happens very sort of quickly. And then you mix in like war and you mix in, you know, being shell-shocked and survivor's guilt, and you mix in all these other things.
She has those heavy concepts like spirituality.
Yeah.
That's such a big concept to tackle. So, yeah.
Well, I have a lot to talk about
sure.
in both of these two movies. And I think that, I mean, I'm not saying that we have to end the discussion about all these
things. No, the more I get into them, I could talk about this thing for hours. So we probably need to cut it off.
Well, no, I'm saying that, like, part of what we're talking about, well, you'll get my point when I bring up some of these other things, okay?
Well,
so let me bring up my my list, my prepared. I mean, this is like two full pages. Look at this. This is two full pages of notes. Some of it we've already mentioned.
We're going long tonight, people.
We're going long. Okay, so Continental Divide. I'll just get over the gloss fluff stuff. Most of the mountain scenes that were very, very pretty that everybody loves were filmed in mostly in Colorado, in Custer County. But the scene where they're on the like up on the where she takes them, where there's the tent.
There's like the summit. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a summit. That is in Glacier National Park in Montana. And also I think it's no. The peak is in Crystal Mountain near Mount Rainier, which is in Virginia. The character, Ernie Selchak, was loosely based on a real character. Longtime Chicago newspaper columnist Mike Ryko. He had a weekly political column, and if you'd like to learn more about him, there is a book that is the collection of articles called Boss, which is an unauthorized biography of the Chicago mayor, Richard Daley. So a lot of that was sort of based in sort of, you know, ripped from the headlines kind of thing, where he did a lot of expose pieces on Richard Daley, and that was sort of the inspiration for the Ernie Selchak character.
Well, I imagine that's probably pretty interesting, right?
Yeah. So if you like the stories of the, you know, all the mayor and the, you know, all that kind of stuff. So so look for that book, Stores Near You. So the actress Blair Brown, you mentioned what a great actress she was. She was nominated for a Golden Globe as her role as Nell.
She's really good in it, yeah.
She was really good, and I'm surprised I haven't seen her in more movies or other
movies.
Yeah,
I've never seen her in anything before, but she is like she is luminous in this film.
Right. So here is the most one of the most interesting things I found out about this movie. I mentioned before that it was the first movie produced by Amblin Entertainment, which means that Spielberg got involved, right? Yeah. So the story goes that Spielberg originally purchased Continental Divide from Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers bought Continental Divide because Kasdan was selling like TV commercials and Starsky and Hutch episodes, and then Universal buys Continental Divide. They weren't doing anything with it. Sat around for a few years. Steven Spielberg heard that they wanted to sell it. He read it and said, "Yep, I want to buy it." So bidding war. So I mean, Universal bought it for like $100,000, okay, which is pretty standard for that type of movie at that time because it was a pretty kind of standard movie. Well, Steven Spielberg gets involved in buying it, and then there's a bidding war that happens, and then Spielberg eventually buys it for like $250,000,
which that's a lot of money at that time.
I know, it's still a lot. So, but it quickly becomes when Lawrence Kasdan first meets Steven Spielberg, he said, "Yeah, I love that movie. I want to direct it. I want to do all this stuff." And he's like, "Okay, sure, yeah." Then he buys it and he's like, "Oh, okay, he's gonna direct it. This is great." So Spielberg's like, "Yeah, why don't you fly out here? Let's talk about the movie." And he gets there and he's like, "Yeah, I don't know if I'm gonna direct it." He's like, "Okay." But he's like, "Yeah, here, let me introduce you to my buddy. We're working on this movie. I wonder if you could help us out." And that was when he wrote Indiana Jones, the first Indiana Jones
Raiders
movie.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
And the whole reason it becomes evident to Lawrence Kasdan, he said in interviews, that the whole reason he found out very quickly, the whole reason that he wanted him out there was because they loved this strong female character of Nell. So they wanted her, like, they saw Marion, you know, and they said, "Oh, Nell is Marion."
And she basically is a like the Neo Marion. There's even a scene in Continental Divide that is basically a scene that was later reused in Raiders of the Lost Ark. There's a scene where, you know, Andy's all beaten up on the ship, and Marion's asking where things hurt, and he goes, "Here," and he points to his head, and she kisses his head, and then he goes, "Here," and points to his chest, and she kisses his chest. That scene verbatim happens in Continental Divide because John Belushi gets hurt and she's like, "Where does it hurt?" And he goes, "My head." And it's the exact same scene. And as someone who's never seen this movie before, it blew my mind to see the same scene from Indiana Jones with completely different characters.
Right. Well, come to find out, Spielberg backed out of the movie because of there was some changes and it was reworked by others, and so he just wanted to sort of like, he was more involved with, you know, the other projects and stuff like that. He didn't want to commit to this, like, you know, because I mean, he had just done Jaws, right?
Yeah, he was big,
right?
He had just blown up, basically,
right? And he's like doing these big action, like big budget movies, and then like Zemeckis is like, hey, I want you to do Back to the Future, and then, you know, all this, I mean, that all started to happen in the early 80s. So but Lawrence Kasdan, going back to him, he is a very interesting character to me because he, you know, he has directed movies, he has written movies, but he started off as a writer. And in interviews of him, I also read that, you know, people asked him, like, well, why didn't you, if you wanted to direct, why didn't you go to film school? And he said, well, basically, a writer is a director because, he, you know, a director is just writing the story. You know, so why don't you learn how to write a story before you can direct the story? So that's why I think that he has this innate ability of storytelling, and why I think that, like, Continental Divide, even though that it has its flaws, I mean, remember, this is his first, like, really big movie that he wrote. He went on to write, you know, he co-wrote Raiders of the Lost Ark. He co-wrote Empire Strikes Back. When I started thinking about Empire Strikes Back, think about what of a different character that Princess Leia was in the first Star Wars movie to Empire Strikes Back.
Yes, she has even more agency, and she's a more nuanced character for sure.
Right, and she has more sort of like gusto. She isn't just like yelling to be a, you know, a princess. Like, she's really sort of like a more of sort of a take charge kind of character.
Yeah.
But he also wrote The Big Chill, Grand Canyon, Return of the Jedi. He had, was co-writing credit in The Force Awakens and in the new movie, Solo.
Yeah, so, he's a very, very accomplished. He's a gifted writer.
Here's another interesting fact about him. He wrote The Bodyguard.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know it either. It was rejected by studios 67 times.
Wow.
So, because they didn't know what to do with it. Because it's basically, you know, a black singer and a white guy. No studio wanted to touch it.
At the time, that was still pretty controversial. Yeah.
So, finally, in 1992, because he wrote it in, like, the mid-70s, right? Finally, in 1992, it gets picked up by Warner Brothers. And then they, you know, Kevin Costner. And
it's a huge hit.
I know, right? But, I mean, he had this idea. It was in the mid-70s he comes up with this idea, this concept. His son also is a very accomplished director.
Jake
Kasdan, Wyatt Earp, Bad Teacher, Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story, Jumanji, Freaks and Geeks, Fresh Off the Boat. He does a lot of, like, comedy type stuff.
Yeah, like, I mean, his voice is kind of like his father's, but it's a little bit more silly.
Right.
It doesn't quite have the earnestness that his father's writing has.
Right. But going back to Continental Divide, Kasdan wrote Continental Divide in 2 lunch hours in the grass in front of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art.
Huh.
So I wonder if he started thinking about, like, all these things. Like, I just imagine that those 2 hours of writing. And he said he didn't write the whole script, but he basically had the storyline for it. The other thing is, this is the only movie John Belushi appeared without Dan Aykroyd.
Really?
Yeah.
That makes sense. I just never thought about it, but you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also not the, it's one of the last movies that John Belushi ever did, but it wasn't the last. The last movie was a movie that's not very good called, Neighbors.
Oh, yeah, Neighbors is not very good.
Either. Yeah, I've seen with Neighbors. Dan Aykroyd, yeah. That was the last movie that John Belushi was in.
Yeah.
And then the other kind of, like, weird thing is that John Belushi, you know, he dies, and then Bill Murray plays Venkman. It was written for John Belushi. Though Dan Aykroyd also had another script that was also written for John Belushi called Spies Like Us. And Spies Like Us, the Chevy Chase character was supposed to be also John Belushi.
And if you look at that Spies Like Us, it feels like it could very easily be played by, like, prime Belushi. I mean,
yeah.
Something about the way the character carries themselves.
Yeah.
Feels like it could easily be Belushi.
Right. But I still love Chase and Spies Like Us.
And we'll get to Chase and those movies at some point for sure.
But either which way, this movie has a very positive 78% rating, Continental Divide does, on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Like, we talked about the flaws of both the movies, but I think both these movies are very worthwhile, and I would encourage people to watch them.
Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars. Hmm. Well, and you know Roger Ebert, he worked for the Chicago Sun-Times.
He did,
right?
Yeah.
Now, he would know about newspaper reporters who work for the Chicago Sun-Times. Yeah. But so they asked him, you know, he's like, well, is this true? He said, well, he's like no newspaperman I know, but exactly like every newspaper man would like to be.
Sort of in a, because everyone would like to be that plugged in and kind of that loved by the city. Because it feels kind of fantastical, it really.
Right, and then Belushi, he kind of says the same thing you did. He said that Belushi's character in this movie is quite unlike his self-destructive slob in National Lampoon's Animal House. It shows gentleness and vulnerability that make him so appealing in some of Second City's quieter skills. Because we forget that John Belushi he hails from Second City.
Yeah, that's true.
Totally weird.
And he does have kind of like a small, quiet child quality about him sometimes.
Right.
Which makes him seem very kind of, you know, just gentle.
Oh, and the last thing, the girl who played Marion in the Indiana Jones movies, she was in Animal House.
She was, yes.
Yeah. So that's another like weird sort of connection.
All those weird overlapping.
Okay, the razor's edge. We said it was from a novel that was written in 1944 and by W. Somerset Maugham, and he was a British playwright, and he basically got the inspiration when he was an ambulance driver in the Great War himself as part of the literary ambulance drivers of 23 other writers that included E.E. Cummings and Ernest Hemingway.
That's quite astute company, really.
Maugham didn't believe in God or the afterlife, and that the misery and bitterness of the world suggested that God did not exist.
Kind of see that in the way the film plays out a little bit.
Yeah, so, I mean, that kind of goes along with the movie as well. So how the movie came about and how Murray wanted to do this movie is that his wife actually had a copy, and then so he read it and fell in love with it. And then he heard, John Byram wanted to do a film adaptation, okay? This guy, John Byram, right? He brought a copy of the book to his friend Margaret, who was in the hospital after giving birth. Margaret was Bill Murray's wife. Then he gets a call the next day at 4 a.m., from Bill Murray, and he said he calls this guy that gives, you know, he wanted to do the movie, and he called him and he said, this is Larry Darrow. Mm-hmm. so he basically like totally wanted to do, you know, because that's his name. Do we call him? I don't know if you call him.
Maybe we called him Elliot. Called him Elliot the entire time.
Called him Elliot. His name is Elliot. Was his friend.
Yeah, so we're not going to fix this in post, ladies and gentlemen, but Bill Murray's character's name was Larry the entire time.
His name is Larry Darrow.
That's just what a force of personality that Bill Murray is, that we just couldn't remember his character's name. But we are not going to alter this because, you know, mistakes happen.
Right. So it was, I said 16 million. I'm sorry, it was 12 million.
Still, the movie looks way more expensive than that.
And it only grossed 6 million.
Yeah, again, because you imagine people wanted to see, like, hey, I love meatballs. Let's go watch The Razor's Edge.
Roger Ebert. Oh, and on the last day of filming this movie, the next day he goes to film Ghostbusters.
That had to be quite a shock to the system, really, because those are two very different films. Yeah.
And then Roger Ebert gave it, he said it was flawed. pointed the hero to too passive, too contained, too rich in self-irony really to sweep along us in his quest. He placed the blame on Murray's shoulder, saying, plays the hero as a fate, as a comedian, and he is the straight man.
That is, that's all very, very fair criticism. It's all true.
Yeah.
I mean, Ebert's dead on there. It really, whether you can get past that stuff or not is really the key on how much you'll enjoy this film. It's flawed. Ebert is right in his assumption, in his criticisms.
Well, Ebert rated it 2.5 stars. I mean, would you agree with that?
I'd actually... 2.5 stars to me, that's 2.5 stars to me, I think of it as a 5-star rating scale.
Right.
To me, that says average.
Well, his is a 4-star scale. Okay. Remember that.
Well, that's he's saying above average. So, yes, if on that scale, 2.5 stars on a 4-star scale, I would agree with that because my own scale is a 5-star scale.
Right.
And I would say 3 stars.
Yeah.
Which
okay.
Because cool, it has some massive flaws in it.
Yeah.
But it's so ambitious and it's so intriguing in its ideas. And really, it's so unique. You're not going to see many films like this ever in your life.
Well, both these films, I mean, unlike like Hudson Hawk, which I wouldn't recommend, you know, and I would probably give it, you know, 2 stars out of 3 or something.
I'd recommend Hudson Hawk to people I hate.
Yeah, go see that movie. Yeah, sure, dude. no, it's great, man. I think both movies are sort of like, I don't like the star system. I just, you know, if it's worth your time, it's worth your time. Yes. Like, if it's worth watching, it's worth watching, no matter what, you know.
Yeah. I in my own writing as a film journalist, I don't use the star rating system. That's just my own personal, like, mental way of thinking about it. But, I mean, I think that it's all nuance, and films have merit and, you know, have good and bad qualities. And I think Ebert's right in his... Everything he wrote there is very accurate. I completely agree with Ebert there.
Yeah, some other New York Times, Janet Maslin said it was disjointed. It has a 50% Rotten Tomatoes rating. But so it's kind of like the same similar thing. Like it's sort of like split whether, you know, some people really love it or really don't like it.
It's just such a very personal film. It's, you can tell it, you know, it's not an easy movie to watch.
Right.
Not. I mean, it's got heavy ideals. It's kind of weirdly disjointed in places, but it's fascinating because it commits to being, you know, it's wholly commits to this concept that it's trying to get across, and that's admirable.
Well, Murray even has considered his hopes for the film's reception a mistake, but however, like in more recent modern times, as we've gotten more sort of introspective, if you will, that it has gained a lot more sort of notoriety for the themes that it has within.
Well, as we've all gotten more fascinated with the idea of spirituality in you know, the 21st century than they were in the 1980s. The 1980s were the beginning of you know, Reaganomics and the idea of, you know, get what you can, greed is good. We've kind of moved past a lot of that to where we're now more concerned with mental well-being and emotional well-being. And that's really what a lot of the film is about. That's why, you know, I'm kind of strangely fascinated with the film right now, is because those things are very interesting to me as a person. I'm very much into the idea of spirituality and psychology, sociology, and, you know, the movie plays in those sandboxes.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see that would be really challenging for someone in 1984.
Right.
But in 2018...
Well, especially after you just saw Ghostbusters.
After you just saw Ghostbusters. Again, I really love Meatballs. But in 2018, where we're all more used to the idea of thinking about life and what does the world mean, what does life mean, it just seems way more natural for to follow a character on that kind of journey because so many people in their own lives are going through similar journeys.
Yeah, and I think that you know, it almost takes a sort of more mature, sort of older audience too to appreciate it. I mean, you know, if I watched this movie when I was 25, I probably would think it was stupid.
Or I'll be like, what's going on?
Oh, yeah, a bunch of people die. Like, he's just running around in Paris and, you know, whatever.
Now he's a monk.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't get what this movie was about. But now, I mean, now, as I'm a 41-year-old male, like, I can kind of appreciate it.
As we are middle-aged men who are staring down the, you know, the great unknown of older age, I get it, man. I get what he's talking about.
Yeah, well, Nathan Rabin of the AV Club in 2007, he's quoted, "If the Razor's Edge is ultimately a failure, it is an honest, noble one." And we mentioned this before in the kind of the pre-production about, is it a noble failure of Bill Murray to, you know, do this kind of movie? Like, it's a failed movie. It didn't quite get the reception it needed. You know, but was it a noble sort of failure?
I honestly mean it is. I mean, it's a noble failure. And I want to say this right now, I kind of love this movie. Not where I can say that I think it's a 4-star movie and thumbs up, but I love that it exists and that it's out there, and that for people who are going to need it and want to go on this journey with these characters, with Bill Murray's character, and it's gonna find people and it's gonna speak to them, you know, long after we're gone. And, you know, so even that, I just like that something that's so audacious and so such a unique vision is out there for people to discover. I love that about it. And even though it's deeply flawed, I think it's, in a way, it's just amazing that it even exists in the first place.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sort of fascinated with it. Like I said, from the perspective of not only does it talk about all those themes that you talked of so eloquently spoke about.
Thank you.
That, you know, like I said before, I think it speaks to, because it was a passion project that Bill Murray instantly signed on. I mean, this guy read the book, you know, this book that was written in 1944, probably from a guy that he never heard of, picks it up, reads it, calls the guy the next day, says, let's do this film. He's willing to do this, like, goofball comedy.
That he doesn't want to do.
He really wants to do serious films.
Yeah.
And he says, this is the film I'm going to do.
And if you think about it, that movie's reminding him of his friend who passed away. That's how much he doesn't want to do it.
Right.
Yeah. Because, I mean, he's taking on a role that was going to be played by his good friend who just died.
Right. Well, that's the reason that he didn't want to do the movie, because he felt that the role was Belushi's, and he felt like if he did it, he actually had to have rewrites because he didn't want to do jokes that were even remotely close to what Belushi would do. He wanted to do his own thing. He didn't want to do what Belushi did because he didn't want to. I think it's one of those things, again, where it's survivor's guilt. You don't want to, you know, benefit from the success of your friend who passed away. You know, you don't want to take, you know, just because my friend died doesn't mean I get to eat his cake.
And, you know, that goes back to again, deeper ideas, and that's why. And again, ladies and gentlemen, these are why we wanted to talk about these films. These why these films are noteworthy, because it's making us think about things like this.
Well, after the movie, I mean, obviously the movie failed. Everywhere Bill Murray goes, he's getting, you know, notarized as you know, Venkman, right? He can't go anywhere in New York City without getting just like mauled by people. Because this was a huge movie.
It was.
And here he was in the middle of New York City where the film was shot and everybody knows who he is. He had to grow a beard. He was just like, I can't live here. I can't live here. I can't do this. So he actually kind of semi-retired or kind of did what the character in the book did and went to Paris for 4 years to figure out what he wanted to do.
Kind of the beginning of the more kind of a flighty idea of Bill Murray that's so commonplace now, that you don't really know what he's going to do or where he's going to be at any particular time. He just kind of took off to Paris.
Yeah. I mean, he only appeared in like a cameo in like Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah,
and that was probably just for a favor for a friend or something. You know, I think he's even uncredited.
Yeah, because he Rick Moranis, you know, he's good friends with Rick Moranis.
So, and it was like, you know, and Steve Martin too, right? So, and then he's gone. I mean, he just like disappears. And the only reason that he even comes back is because his wife is pregnant. And so, yeah, you know, if they're, you know, he has their kid, you know, is born in France. He wanted to be like an American citizen or whatever. They had to come back. But then he finally comes back. Remember, this is all 1984.
Yeah.
His next big role, 1988, Scrooged.
Yeah. He basically disappears for 4 years.
Yeah. And we don't know where he is. Now, I didn't know this as, I mean, I didn't know that Bill Murray had disappeared when I was a kid.
He did come back for Ghostbusters 2.
That was also 88.
You're right. That was 88. So, yeah. So, forget that. My mistake. Sorry. I didn't think about him being gone for 4 years. I mean, we were just busy watching Ghostbusters.
Right. I was in 84. I was, like, busy, like, you know, playing around, like, riding around my bike, playing with, you know, G.I. Joes and Transformers. Yeah. Like, I didn't know.
Yeah, but I remember, like, you know, Ghostbusters was one of the first videotapes I ever watched. I watched the movie so much when I was a young kid. But, yeah, it's kind of amazing that he just basically disappeared for, you know, almost half a decade.
Well, I mean, apparently everybody was asking, like, Dan Aykroyd and all these other guys, like, aren't you going to do a sequel? Aren't you going to do Ghostbusters 2? Or are you going to do Ghostbusters 2? Everybody was on board, but the studio's like, no, we're not going to do it without Aykroyd.
Or without Murray? Yeah.
We're not going to do it without.
We just can't get his name right today.
No, we can't. Sorry, Bill.
We love you, Bill. We are pro Bill Murray till the day I die. I'm pro Bill Murray.
Yeah, I know. I mean, and I understand so much more of his sort of like what makes Bill Murray tick after seeing this movie.
Yes, and that's why it's a movie that I think if you're a fan of Bill Murray, you got to see it. I mean, right. It's an experience.
But I think it's interesting that he came back and did Scrooged, which Scrooged was also like this flawed character who like finds enlightenment.
Yeah. I think that's probably something that Murray himself is interested in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you hear the way he lives his life, the adventures he has, he's looking for enlightenment. He's looking for something. He's right. Walking his own version of the Razor's Edge.
Very true. I would agree with that, but I don't know Bill Murray personally. You know, we only know what we kind of see of Bill Murray, but what we see of Bill Murray is such a real version of Bill Murray.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't go on like talk shows and just, you know, kind of ham it up, you know? Yeah. What you see him at, you know, Wrigley Field singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Yeah. Or
living, you know, life. He'll just randomly show up at a bar and start tending bar, or he'll wash dishes at a random restaurant, or he'll crash a wedding.
Yeah,
he's living life, and to me that's, you know, it's inspiring and it's beautiful, and you can see the genesis of that kind of personality in, again, to bring it back to The Razor's Edge.
Right, and I mean, and really, when we picked out these movies, the only reason why we even picked out these movies was that they were comedians and they were in this dramatic role, and I had no idea that these two movies would be so close together, because it deals with Belushi and Belushi's death, and deals with, you know, so we pick these movies, know that was not the intention.
Yeah, no, it really was, because we look for vague themes, basically. Well, just a way to very thinly stitch two movies together, and this is one of those times where they just dovetailed into each other beautifully, and I think that it was a great experience watching these movies.
Right.
It gave me a lot to think about. It gave me a lot to mull over. And I felt like I was in the perfect place in my life to watch these movies.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I did. I'm glad we had this experience together. And I mean, thank you for bringing these movies up to me, because I never would have known about Continental Divide without you. And I appreciate that.
Hey man, I appreciate you know, your insight, and it's always wonderful, and that's why I love the show, and that's why I love these reasons to, you know, go back and watch these movies and really experience what they're all about, because even a movie that may be deemed a failure and may only get like 2 stars or may only bring in like, you know, half the grossed amount that it was, you know, budgeted for or whatever, doesn't really necessarily mean that they're bad movies.
No.
And I think that it's wonderful to go back and sort of explore these things. And like I said, I don't think we'll ever have two movies that sort of dovetail, you know, sort of serendipitous together, you know?
And also that hit quite as hard as these did in their own kind of deep metaphysical and emotional way.
Yeah, so sorry for all of the emotions and the feels. And
again, we're sorry we got Bill Murray's character's name wrong for like most of the podcast, but the intent is there. I recommend these films. If I especially recommend The Razor's Edge. I feel like any Bill Murray fan should see it. And if you're looking for interesting passion projects for actors or actors stretching themselves in different roles, it's worth your time.
Right.
And Continental Divide, if you're a Belushi fan, it's worth it to see him in that way because God knows I still miss Belushi.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's also interesting to see, you know, this sort of time period in the 80s where there was, you know, there was trains, there was payphones, there was like newspaper evening editions, you know, so it's kind of, I mean, we grew up in this world, but, you know, to think about that was, you know, almost like so long ago now,
it's,
you
it's,
know,
it's gone. It's gone now. It's like a fantasy world.
Yeah. So, but we would love to hear your thoughts on these movies, what you thought about it, what you, you know, love about, Bill Murray,
John Belushi,
and, we just, can't thank both of them, enough for, you know, making these movies, because these were two very fantastic movies that I completely enjoyed, but we know that they're flawed, but, you know, we'd love sometimes, to hear your thoughts. You know, just let us know.
Sometimes the flaws are what make them wonderful.
Well, yeah, there's that, too. Yeah.
Much like people.
You're just very enlightened today.
I am, yeah. I'm trying to walk my own razor's edge, yeah. But, you know, but thanks, guys, for listening. We love you guys. We want to hear what you think. You know, I think it's time to say goodbye, my friend.
All right. Well, let's go walk that razor's edge, my friend.
Okay, until next time, I'm Matthew Esri.
I'm Ryan Igre.
Go watch some movies, guys.
Columbia Pictures presents Bill Murray in a role unlike anything he's ever done before. The Razor's Edge, based on the classic novel by Somerset Maugham. Story of romance, deception, betrayal, sacrifice, and discovery. A thin line separates love from hate.
You care me so much, Larry.
It's very easy to love someone like you.
Success from failure. Life from death.
When Piedmont died, I found out there's another debt to pay for the privilege of being alive.
A line as difficult to walk as a razor's edge. Bill Murray in the story of one man's search for himself. The Razor's Edge.